journeys. Let's see, in terms of what I do, I have a nonprofit. It's called the Presence Care Project, which is really meant to help disseminate the mindfulness-based care programs that I have developed, including the mindfulness-based dementia care program. Currently, there's a new program that started at UCSF Center for Integrative Medicine. It's an 8-week class, mindfulness-based dementia care, and I'm in the... There's only 2 more weeks this cycle, but we'll start again in the fall. So there are flyers out there if you're ever interested. It's a long way in San Francisco. I also do some consulting for assisted living communities and adult day programs. And I'm also involved in culture change and developing new programs, not just mindfulness-based, but art programs and personalized music programs. And one of these manifestations of the music is I just created an app for the iPad for caregivers that uses personalized music as a way to positively engage persons with Alzheimer's, dementia, stroke, all kinds of conditions, social isolation. So it's going to start testing phase next week, and it should be launched publicly in August. So if you're interested, there's a flyer, and you can email me, and I can keep you updated on that. And then I have a private practice in Palo Alto where I see a few clients, also mostly caregivers and sometimes persons with beginning of mild cognitive impairments, people with Parkinson's, strokes, these kinds of things. So now that I've talked about myself, I would like to go around and kind of get a sense for who is here and what brings you here. So maybe if you can say your name, what brings you here, whether you're a family caregiver or professional care provider, what type of diagnosis do you deal with? And also, I'd like to get a sense of your mindfulness practice, if you've never practiced or if you're practicing. So let's try to keep it short. So let's just start here.
Hi, I'm Kelly Jaramita, and I'm a nurse, and I work for a nursing school just down the road, almost on the other side of Kern. And the one of the many reasons I'm here is to help bring this to our nursing program, the information today, and we're trying to develop a model for our faculty and our staff to support them, so we model it to our students.
Great. Okay.
And I have been to a few of Lori's practices.
Great.
I'm Vivian Jones, and I was a teacher. I'm a retired educator, and I never attended this type of session, but because I'm Linda, she explained it to me, and I thought, this is just what I need. I caregiver for my father, and he's it's a point where I thought, you know, this could be of good use to me, and knowing how to take care of myself and how to better be able to deal with things that come up with him.
Does he have dementia? Or?
He has just some forgetfulness, I think, just the beginning stages, but it's just, it's a challenge now and then.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm Linda Reidenauer. I'm an elementary school counselor, and I'm here for the CEUs, but also to support my cousin, and my parents are 93, and they're in great shape, but caregiving is part of what I do. And also I come here to Lori's group on Sundays and kind of have a practice that I do on my own with my husband and friends. So I'm just here to learn all that I can and support children that I work with also.
Thank you.
My name's Reva, and I've had a spiritual practice since 1979. And I've been involved with Lori's group since we moved here 5.5 years ago. And we're living with my mother-in-law, and we're the only caregivers. And she has short-term memory loss. She's 89. And she's gone 180 degrees in improvement with this care, but it definitely takes its toll on us. And she's pretty much had, I would say, a form of undiagnosed mental illness probably her whole life. Mm. So she's doing remarkably well, but it's, everybody understands.
I'm Robin. I'm a nurse. I was working in long-term care for the last 2 years, and it definitely took its toll on me working with a lot of dementia patients. And I recently switched over to acute care, and the types of people I work with there are anywhere from Parkinson's and stroke to respiratory issues and such. I've had a meditation practice actively for probably about the last 15 years.
Great, thank you. Just go in the back.
My name's Adler, and I've got a sporadic practice with mindfulness, but I like to, it pays to pay attention, and I got a couple elderly parents. They're not all that elderly, but he just went through open heart surgery, and so I've been taking care of that, and also I look around the world, and there's a lot of care needs to be given, to the world at large, and I think I have something I can contribute, so I thought I might learn something, further my own, peace of mind and mindfulness and all that by doing more of this.
Great, thank you.
And I'm Diane, and I live currently with my mother half for the last 12 years, and she's 94. So that's a challenge for me, and it's getting harder and harder. So I thought I would come and see what things you had to share. And she's fine, really, except for her hearing and her seeing.
The physical.
And we just got back from Alaska, so, she's okay that way, but it's still all on me.
Yes, yes. Okay.
Hi. My name is Barbara, and I work for Allen County Mental Health, and I am an enthusiastic beginner. I've come to two of Lori's Tuesday nights and one training in the county. Mostly here, though, for personal my best friend slash mentor has middle stage dementia, and we had to move her into assisted living about 3 years ago. But I am, I take her to the doctor and
wait,
and do all of that. She has no family. And then in March, my younger sister was diagnosed with advanced stage ovarian cancer and is currently in treatment. And I and my sister's youngest daughter, who's 20, are her primary caregivers covering for lots of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Are you a social worker?
I am a drug counselor.
A drug counselor.
With juvenile girls on probation.
Okay.
I love them.
I'm Jeanette.
Sorry, I didn't get your name.
Jeanette,
okay.
I have private practice in Scotland. And FTE.
My name's Allison. I've been a primary caregiver for my husband, who just turned 66. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's when he was 62, and he's now advanced. Just placed him in a memory care facility, and I'm kind of lost without him. I find myself spending a lot of time there, so I don't have a home. And my sister just was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. I used to do yoga until my husband got where I couldn't leave him by himself anymore, and I really miss it. And the group that Carol and I go to on Monday mornings, this was a handout for this class, and my counselor suggested that I see if I could take some mindfulness training somewhere. And I said, well, look at this. So I'm here, and I think this is the place for me.
Great, that seems like it, yeah. Thank you.
My name's Betty. I live in Patterson. I've been the caregiver for my dad, who's since passed,
seems like it's really recently he passed, but I look back at going on 2 years.
Just yesterday.
Seems like it.
Yeah.
Currently, I work in home health. I'm an LCSW, and I provide individualized support to caregivers. Previously, I've worked pretty intensely with those that have neurological impairments through an adult day program here in town. And kind of episodically, I practice yoga and meditation.
Okay. I'm Virginia Horton. I'm an LCSW, recently retired in February. I work at Memorial Hospital in the employee assistance program and with the employees and family. And I originally did my illness in the 90s with the county. I was the first licensed clinical social worker that I know of that, and I worked with borderlines.
Oh, wow.
And it really did work. I really had some success with it. But I haven't used it a lot because I haven't had the opportunities. So I wanted to come and refresh, and I use it for myself. I do yoga and Tai Chi. Strength training since I've retired, so, and I caregive also with my cousin, with my mother's older sister, and Uncle Walter has Alzheimer's, and she has mental illness, and I'm all the time ending up at ER to the doctor, and I take them out for rides, anything we can do.
This is a great reminder.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, no shame.
Okay. I'm Rose Mitchell. I'm an LCSW. I'm retired from behavioral health, county mental health programs, almost 3 years ago now. And I have a partner who is older than I am. I'm 66 and she's older. And she's diabetic and she needs a lot of prompting. And I'm noticing that my patience is challenged. And I'm wanting to learn better ways to take care of myself and stay committed to the kindness in my heart, but sometimes harder to reach.
Yes.
During stressful times.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Okay.
My name is Jimmy, and I'm an LCSW at the Doctors Medical Center. My focus here is primarily on terminally ill and probably primarily cancer patients. I had meditation practice for 10 years about, and my husband is doing the work because he's going to stepfather. I just moved that, and so that's factoring into sort of what I think I'll take away from today.
Your husband is caring for his dad?
His stepdad.
His stepdad. And what is his job?
Actually, I think my husband and his siblings are sort of teaming up to care for him. He's just been placed in assisted living. He lost his wife a year ago, and he just he coped very poorly with that. And many issues arose, and so he went from living very independently, and I think because of her, he kept them very independent, and he just became much more... He's lost.
Does he have dementia?
He's got some mild dementia.
Hi, I'm Carol, the disruptive person. And I used Allison's excuse. Both of our husbands were placed within the same week. And my husband's 64, I'm 65, so they're about a year apart. This is my Allison, Lori. Lori's heard about Allison for quite a while. I've known Lori for several years now. I am a retired school teacher, and I had to teach something, so I went into yoga teacher training, and within 6-7 months of becoming certified, I got my husband diagnosed with Alzheimer's, because I figured I could do everything.
connected for myself, thinking that it was my problem because he was so young. And then finally, that summer, I was able to get doctors to say. So, basically, like Allison, we're adjusting to not having husbands live with us. It's like another category. We're not divorced, widowed. Mm-hmm. We have a husband, you know, who doesn't live with us. But I've had a yoga and meditation practice for many years, so I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you, too.
I'm Julie, retired elementary school teacher. I'm currently not a caregiver, but my mother is 85, and I'm going to see the day when she may need it. My dad had dementia, and I assisted with taking care of him. He's since passed. And currently my boyfriend, I think, is starting to suffer with some early onset, maybe some early dementia. And as my friend Chris said, at our age, I was talking about whether I should come to this or not and give up the day. And she said, at our age, the chances of becoming a caregiver are pretty great for somebody. And I, personally, I also have suffer off and on with anxiety and depression. I thought I could help myself. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
great.
Well, and I have a sporadic, as I said, a meditation practice, more on and off in the last 5 years, and I also do prison work with Lori's group in the prison.
Thank you.
I'm Chris, and I'm going to borrow several concepts that people have mentioned. I've had a sporadic practice for 35 years. Didn't take hold until maybe 8 years or so ago when I met Lori up in Tuolumne County, and most active in the last 4 years. I am retired clinical social worker, 40 years, mostly with behavioral health. The last few years with integrated behavioral health in a primary care setting, which was a different experience for me. And I'm not a caregiver at the moment, but I have a partner of 17 years who has been diagnosed with 4-stage cancer. Mm-hmm. And 8 years ago, was mm-hmm. given 2.5 years at that point to yeah. live. And, you know, so we don't expect anything to happen anytime soon. But in the meantime, I kind of try to prepare myself for yes. doing some physical and emotional
yes.
care, end-of-life care.
Okay. Wow. This is a great group. Very good fit with what I'm going to talk about. So thank you. I feel very blessed to be in this space with you. First I want to do a little bit of talking, and then we'll do practice, we'll alternate. I want to talk about caregiving challenges and stress, which you seem to all know a lot about. But I just want to go over some numbers. These are from the Alzheimer's Association and relate to dementia, but they can really extend to other conditions. Dementia caregivers are suffering from high emotional stress, 61%, high physical stress, 43%. Depression, and that's a number I like to highlight, is 40%. So the likelihood of having depression when you're a dementia caregiver and others, dealing with other long-term conditions is really high. So to be on the lookout for these red flags, you know, if you stop talking to people and stop having any structure in your life, feeling tired, not sleeping or eating or overeating, any of these things, or your mood, it's just time to maybe go to the doctor or talk to a therapist. Feel on duty 24/7 during last year of care, 59%. And then the last number really speaks to the suffering involved. Feel relief when the person dies, 72%. So if you have some of those emotions, you know, realize that these are part of the course. So learning how to manage stress is critical for both, not just emotional, but also physical health. And also our ability to provide care.
So the reason why we pair mindfulness with caregiving is because as some of you, how many of you are familiar with mindfulness-based stress reduction? So about half. So I'll talk about that. In the last few years, mindfulness has become the focus of attention by neuroscientists in terms of its power to reduce stress. And now there's about 120 studies, serious research studies, that prove that it indeed works. What started all this is a gentleman by the name of Jon Kabat-Zinn out of the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He started a program 30 years ago, mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is an 8-week program, about 2.5 to 3 hours a week, and it combines meditation, yoga, group sharing, some kind of cognitive-inspired exercises. And it's been only within the last 3 to 5 years that it's taken off. So now it's taught pretty much everywhere, in hospitals, clinics, prisons, schools. Google teaches it. There's no place that is not touched by MBSR. And then there's been a whole bunch of spin-offs, you know, MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression, DBT for borderline disorders, mindfulness-based eating, mindfulness-based couples something, mindfulness-based for recovery. So this is the mindfulness-based dementia care. It's kind of the last child of this, from this family. It combines some principles of MBSR, the 8-week training, the retreat day, group sharing, lectures on dementia, and particularly the experiential model of care, and then mindfulness practices, solo practices, and also mindful care practices, and dementia awareness practices. And I teach both mindfulness-based dementia care and mindfulness-based care, but it's very similar. It's pretty much the same thing. There's also a really cool study that speaks to the stress of caregiving that I want to talk about. It's from UCSF, a researcher called Elizabeth Blackburn. So she's looked at the chromosomes and the protective caps at the end of the chromosomes, which are called the telomeres. It's like, you know, at the end of shoelaces, you have these little caps. It looks just like that. And she's interested in looking at cellular aging and how stress affects cellular aging. And the longer the telomeres, the less you age. And she's showing that long-term caregiving, she looked at two groups, mothers of chronically ill children and then dementia caregivers. And she's shown that her research shows that the telomeres are substantially shortened. And the enzyme, the telomerase, that helps keep the telomeres healthy is much lower. So then now she started another study, which is looking at mindfulness and the impact of mindfulness on those telomeres and the telomeres, and she's showing that it's actually reversing. So it's a very graphic when you look at that picture. I sometimes show the picture of the chromosomes and those red caps, and you know, and just to think about what it does to us. But we have an antidote, which is mindfulness, that's so readily available to us. So that's really a compelling reason to practice. And if you haven't taken the practice, is to start the practice. And there's a few of you, I guess, who have not really practiced mindfulness, so I just want to talk about the what mindfulness is. Or maybe some of you that have practiced, maybe you can speak to what it is for you. Do any of you want to give a short version of what mindfulness is for you?
Being aware.
Being aware?
Which, you know, when your mind is going off somewhere and suddenly you pull yourself back into
yes.
the present.
Right, so it's a practice of staying in the present moment.
A billion times a day.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think of it as, and this has been used before, bringing the mind into the body.
Uh-huh.
So that you're not just in your head, you're aware of what's happening in the functioning of your body, your breathing, you become more aware of what's happening in all the different systems in your body rather than just being in your head.
Yes. Yes, that would be one of the practices. So it's the ability to be in the aware of a present moment on purpose mm-hmm. and without judgment. So whatever's going on, we just look at it. So the other reason to practice mindfulness as a caregiver, so there's twofold. One is the stress reduction, and the other one is the ability to provide the best care possible. And the reason for that is it teaches us to be present and not be limited by our thinking mind and our expectations of how things should be, how they were, or how we want them to be. It just teaches us to be right there. It also enables us to bring a calm, centered presence to the care situation. And that's probably one of the most important things that a person needs that's receiving care, for us to be calm and centered. It allows us to respond and not react. And God knows when you're a caregiver, a long-term caregiver, you get so frazzled sometimes or so burned out that your reactivity just goes up and you lose your patience. So it teaches you to bring that pause in between the stimulus and our response. It also teaches us environmental awareness, which is being aware of us, the other person, and the whole environment. For instance, right now it would be the sound, it'd be this moving around, it'd be the awareness of all of us in the room, it might be the temperature, awareness of the temperature, awareness of what we see. So it's very important, particularly when dealing with someone with dementia or stroke. It also enables us to connect beyond words, to learn to be comfortable with not talking, and being with somebody that does not talk anymore, particularly at end of life or dementia, advanced dementia. And then it allows us to meet the person who's suffering from memory loss, particularly in their present moment reality, which is what they are, because they've lost the ability to relate to the past or to plan for the future. So we're right there with them, no matter what it means. So if you do this practice, it really helps with both this stress reduction and then feeling more confident and capable of providing the care. And then it benefits the other person, and it's kind of this spiral. Rather than spiraling down, it enables us to spiral up, actually, towards joy. So I'd like to give two quotes. One is from Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, "The most precious gift we can offer others is our presence. When mindfulness embraces those we love, they will bloom like flowers." And it is so true, including when dealing with someone with dementia, to see that within their limited range of abilities, that they can actually reach well-being if we're able to provide that environment. This is a quote from Nancy Pugh. She's a social worker, geriatric social worker. She wrote a great book. It's called Inside Alzheimer's. And it's an old book, but it's really filled with great stories. She says, "I've discovered that it is not so much about what I did or did not say or do that was key to pass on to professionals and family members. It was more about the way in which I was being with the persons with dementia that seemed important to communicate. Each person with dementia has taught me the importance of relaxing into being in the present moment." So this is how persons with dementia are teachers. They're not teachers in the traditional sense of mindfulness teachers, but they really force us to be in the present moment. And they remind us through their behaviors if we're not in the present moment. So it's kind of like Zen master that hits you with a stick, you get hit with behaviors. So I'd like to start practicing. So I'm going to teach very simple things, maybe not as long as what traditional mindfulness practices are, because I'm aware that some of you want to bring that back to your work, and that I'm very aware of the limitations of what you can bring into care environments, and also that it's important to keep it simple so you can transmit it, and then it can, you know, ripple effects. We could go very fancy with practices, but people won't remember them, or they won't be able to. So we're going to start with a mindful check-in practice. So I'm going to invite you to just sit like we are, putting both feet on the floor. And then closing our eyes, sitting up straight, taking a few moments to adjust our posture so we can hold it. Usually the more the straighter your spine, the easier it is to stay seated for longer periods of time. Although here we're only going to do this for 5 to 10 minutes. So this is called a mindful check-in. And it's really taking a few minutes from our day to check in with ourselves and notice what's going on inside. Starting with our body, our feet, the left foot that is touching the floor, joining the world of sensations, feeling our foot, the sole of our foot against the floor. And then do the same thing with our right foot. And then moving up, using the points of contact as place to bring our awareness. This time, going to the place of contact between the thighs and the butt and the chair. And again, getting into the sensations. There. And then moving up, feeling our whole body sitting quiet and still. And then turning to our heart, noticing any emotions that may be present currently. Paying attention to our mind and the thoughts that may be coursing through. Paying attention to the overall feeling, whether pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Doing all this without judgment, simply noticing. And now turning to the breath, wherever it is most prominent in the body. And we're practicing finding the breath, wherever it is easiest to notice, whether in the belly or the chest, or the back of the throat, or the nose, or anywhere else. And then our job for the next few minutes is simply to sit back and notice the comings and goings of the breath in our body, realizing that there's nothing to do. The breath takes place all by itself. In this quiet place, our awareness may be drawn now to the noise, which is overriding the breath. This may happen in institutions or at home. So when that's the case, rather than fighting the other phenomenon, I'd like to invite you now to shift to paying attention to the sound. So every time the mind wanders away into thoughts, bring it back to the sound. Hearing, mindfulness of hearing. Paying attention to our reaction, maybe to the sound also. And going back to the hearing. Going back to the breath, following the ins and outs of the breath. When ready, let's open our eyes slowly, letting the light in. And getting used to the room and each other. So this is a very short practice. This is about 6 minutes. And I just want to talk about Zen Hospice and how Zen Hospice, every shift change for the volunteers, which is 5 hours, starts like this. Sitting together and then sharing what's been going on, just very short. And that's such a simple practice, but it's really amazing what it does. You can bring this in many settings. That would be the number one practice I'd like to impart here. And you can end your day in the same way. So if you don't ask too much, you're more likely to be able to have some change taking place in some of the institutions that you work at. So, and you can do this at home too, starting your day like this. And I really encourage starting the day with some practice, however short that may be, because that's going to carry you through the rest of the day. And you're going to have it for you, but you're also going to share it with other people because you're going to be more calm and centered. So for those of you who like to practice at home, on the Presence Care Project website, I have a podcast of all the practices that I teach at UCSF. So you can just go there and listen to them or download them. And I want to read another quote. This is from another great book. It's from Olivia Ames Hoblitzel. She wrote the book 10,000 Joys and 10,000 Sorrows about her journey with her husband who had Alzheimer's. They were both mindfulness practitioners. She said, if I hadn't had the thread of practice to hold on to, I don't know how I would have managed. Countless times I needed to anchor myself in the next breath. I needed to feel the solidity of my body instead of spinning off into thoughts and feelings which would sabotage the equanimity that my husband's situation demanded. I had to keep coming home to myself. If I didn't, I would get lost in the complexity of so many demanding moments. And then this is another quote from another teacher that I love. Her name is Charlotte Selber. She invented sensory awareness, or learned it from some other teacher in Germany, I think, but she brought it to the U.S. And she says, like the curtain is moved by the wind, so we are moved inside by our breathing, without doing anything for it. If you gently give up doing it, you will experience that it comes all by itself. We should not be the educators of breathing. Breathing should teach us how it wants to be without admonishing it. And I think how we relate to the breath is really important, and how we talk about the breath. Oftentimes we say, oh, take a breath. Well, taking a breath is not really what we need to do. What we need to do is really finding the breath, because it's always there. We don't need to take anything. So it's finding it and just following it. That's the main practice. So I'd like to invite you to reflect now. Take a little time, each of you. How much you implement this in your place of work or at home? Thinking, if you don't have a practice yet, what time would be the best time for you? And where would you do this? And if it's at work, what first step might you take to bring this into your place of work or care institution? You might use this moment to put out an intention of practice. And I also want to talk briefly about some research that's done at Stanford on behaviors and new habits from a professor, his name is B.J. Fogg, at the Persuasive Technology Lab. And he talks about tiny habits. And mindfulness is really a habit. So he says, if we want to take a new habit, we have to make it tiny at first. Because if we try to tackle something too big, we're not going to do it. And that's why so many of us stick on mindfulness and then we stop and then we try again and we stop. So, because we don't pay enough attention to this seeding of a habit. So his theory is that for each new habit, we need to anchor it into an existing habit. Something we already do habitually every day. So for me, it's about getting up. So when I get up, I put on my robe, which I do anyway, and then rather than starting anything, even brushing my teeth, I go to my seat and I start the practice. Because if I do anything else, I know that I'm not going to do it. You know, if I start looking at my phone, forget it. If I start drinking my tea, forget it. So it's about whatever, this is my habit, the existing habit, and my brain has learned to recognize it, that it means, now it's synonymous with practice in the morning. So you may have other habits that you, you know, at work, it's, I work in an assisted living community 2 days a week, and I've taken the habit to, they usually do what they call stand-ups, which is a weird name for getting together in the morning. So now I call them sit-downs. And so, but now when they do the sit-downs, at the end, we do this practice. So that's become a habit now. So I don't have to be there. They do it when I'm not there too. So it's an example of bringing this into an institution. Okay. So then I'd like to switch to a little bit of didactic about what I call experiential model of care, which I learned from Dr. Alan Power. He wrote a book called Dementia Beyond Drugs. It's a great book. It's not just about dementia. It really, you can use it for other. And he learned it himself from other people, including Tom Kidwood in the UK. So it's really about training ourselves to be in the other person's shoes. And he says, we often position the dependent person as being less capable and less understanding than she really is. Positioning can lead to the inability to recognize unmet needs, improper interpretation of words or actions, and exclusion of a person from the opportunity to engage in all aspects of meaningful life. So I teach something called positioning and repositioning practice, which is really a mindfulness practice, because it presupposes that we are aware of our thoughts. So we train our mind to be aware of what we're thinking, what we're feeling when we come into a care situation. So as we approach a person, it's asking ourselves, what am I thinking about that person? What am I feeling? Am I feeling sympathy, pity, fear, disgust, frustration? What's here? Or am I feeling joy and calmness? And do I position this person as less capable than they are? This is so prevalent, both at home and in institutions. My mom was in the hospital 3 months ago for a stroke, and when she was about to be discharged, the head doctor came in, and he walked into the room, said hi to me, did not even acknowledge my mom, who was fully aware. She could no longer speak, but she was fully aware. So it was as if she was not there, and then proceeded to discuss the whole, her diagnosis, which she actually did not know about dementia and Alzheimer's, but he just blurted it out. And then, discussed prognosis, outcome, treated her like, she was just a patient. And that was the whole encounter. So this is an example of positioning the person as non-existent here. And it's not just it's his fault, it's just the whole environment is like this. I do this all the time because our brain is conditioned by what we see. So if you see someone, particularly in the, is this falling off? Yeah, the glasses were playing with this. If you see someone that's in a wheelchair or lying down and that seems like they checked out, which might happen when someone has dementia or a stroke or anything, any other severe illness, what our brain takes in is that this person is not there. And then it goes from there to overriding them and just talking about them or doing things for them. Not giving them the benefit of the doubt in terms of what they can still do. So it's really important. The practice then becomes to readjust, once we become aware of this, to readjust what we're thinking and how we're feeling in our attitude. And I tell myself, there's a whole person there. I have a sentence. You may have a different sentence, but that's how I just get back into the mode of, okay, this is how I need to be, And then another notion tied to this experiential model is care partnering. And this is from another great book. Christine Bryden is a person with dementia. She's been an incredible advocate for anyone with dementia. She wrote a great, wonderful book called Dancing with Dementia. It's probably the best book in terms of if you want to understand what it's like to have dementia. She really is an amazing bridge in terms of articulating her experience and telling us what she needs. And she says, we need to move away from labeling ourselves as caregiver and sufferer towards becoming a care partnership in which we accept, collaborate, and adapt to new roles within the journey of care. I can become a survivor, a person with dementia, and you can be my care partner on this journey. I can be a care partner with you, communicating my true feelings, my true needs, so that you can walk alongside me, adjusting and compensating for these expressed needs as we face this struggle together. So, this is called caregiving, this workshop, and we call ourselves caregivers. So that word is actually loaded because it kind of it boxes into this narrow definition of ourselves as people that only give, and we cannot receive from the other person. So it's bad for us, it's bad for the other person. So maybe you'll continue to call yourself caregiver, but think about care partnering in terms of the role that you play. And in institutions, it's like the whole team becomes care partners with the person and then dealing with the illness. Another notion, and this is really, really key and leads, not respecting those two things, I would say leads to 90% of the problem behaviors, particularly in dementia or long-term care. It's I borrowed this notion from Jane Verity from Dementia Care Australia, and she talks about the five universal emotional needs that we all have. But when someone has dementia or becomes in a situation of dependence, long-term dependence, this becomes even more important. And I narrowed it down to two, because I find that those are the two that I keep coming across over and over again, and noticing when things don't work, just because one of those two needs has not been met. So these are two top emotional needs. The first one is to enable the person the ability to make decisions still. Having the power to choose and have control, some control over our life, is critical. So when you're dealing with dementia, it can become tricky because you can't just tell the person, oh, what do you want to do? Because that's not going to work. So what I do is I usually frame it. Could be something like, well, now it's time to have lunch. And then immediately underneath that, I give two options. So you don't want to give too many options because the person cannot, the brain cannot handle that many possibilities. It's going to stress them out. But give two options. It goes with food. It goes with the time of eating. It goes with maybe the choice of utensils. It goes with how they want to sit. So that's number one. Also, when you help the person get dressed in the morning, give an option, the red sweater or the blue sweater. Or also when they wake up, would you like to wake up now or should I come back in 5 minutes? And then the second one is the need to feel needed and useful. We all need to feel like we're contributing something. Each one of you, when I was listening to you, has a role. An identity. But when we become dependent because of illness, particularly dementia, that gets stripped away from us. And we become irrelevant, and we have no sense of what we can do for others, or what we grieve, what we used to do. And we just wander aimlessly, wondering how can we still feel like we're part of this world. So it becomes our job as care partners to help the person figure out how they can still be relevant. And in assisted living or adult day programs or hospitals, this is so absent. So you need to help the staff there. And the way you do that is you do that by giving information about your loved one. You know, what did they used to do? What do they still like to do? And then being creative. Sometimes you need to translate what they used to do into a new way of, I'm going to give you an example. Somebody who's used to going to work in the morning and then who can no longer do that. Maybe a substitute can be to go to a day program, and the day program becomes a place of work. And then you can partner with the staff there and figure out a job for them to do. Can be as simple as helping with lunch, helping serve the lunch, helping clear the table, helping sweep. But it becomes a new job. That's just an example. So now I'd like to ask you to spend a little time. I'm going to pass around some blank pieces of paper. And thinking about the person that you're caring for, or if you work, you're caring for more than one person, pick one. Just pick one. So this is, you just pass this around.
Anyone needs a pin?
I have a pin. This is a trick.
Okay. Anyone else even have?
That's a good radio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Everyone else is good.
So you each have some paper? And you have picked your person? You know who you're going to think about? Which person? Okay. So I'd like to invite you to think about what is that person's remaining abilities and start writing it down. And that goes from activities of daily living, ability to get dressed, ability to eat on their own, ability to take a shower, ability to go to the bathroom, ability to get dressed, and then work and hobbies, what are their remaining abilities there, house chores and activities, ability to communicate, and any other things that you can think of. So just go down and start writing. These can be very small, they can be very big. Can also include motor abilities, you know, ability to walk or bike or physical abilities. You could also think about cognitive abilities and emotional, you know, ability to convey emotions and the heart abilities. And as you do this, be mindful of what comes up for you when you do this. You know, in terms of emotions or thoughts. And then I'm going to ask you to look at your list and figure out how you could use this list to enable the person's ability to contribute or be helpful or have a role still or a job looking at that list. How could you use that information to encourage? You could come up with several jobs, several ways that the person can contribute, not just one. But you can come up with at least one. Okay, so I would like to invite anybody who would like to share what came up for you as you were doing this. Anything that you care to share with the group. Yes?
Well, I'm just amazed at how much he does. I mean, this is pretty phenomenal. And the chores that we have to do regularly is just putting clothes on top of the dryer and having her fold them, because she likes to do that. And emptying out the dishwasher. And so those are her jobs. And I think she does take some pride in doing those. She is appraised for them all the time. But I do think she feels like she's contributing. And that's just a couple things.
Yes. Okay. Anybody else? Yes.
Well, this is interesting, and I appreciate the process. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I found that it's more my issue. I'm having a problem in adjusting to aging process and wanting things to be different than they are. Mm-hmm. And so it's work that I have to do. My partner can do many things that she's always done, certain things like driving because of vision issues. And mowing the lawn, and we don't do that anyway, somebody else does that. Combing her hair, things that I want her to do. She combs her hair when she wants to comb her hair. And so my nudging and my prompting just exacerbates conversations between us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I think I feel like you're giving us more things that we have to do for this person. Mm-hmm. You know, right now, when we already, some of us are feeling very overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I hope we can sort that out a little
bit. Mm-hmm. So you're like, I don't want to do this work. I have already done too much.
Well, I'm angry.
Yes, yes.
Angry.
I have a comment to add to that. That's what I think with my husband, I am coping. He and his sisters are very angry. I think that, and just briefly, I had a wonderful mother-in-law, and she spoiled her husband. And so when she was gone, his stepfather really just became, I mean, he's very self-involved, and he's very, I think the older he gets, the more, I mean, to give him a job or a task wouldn't be, I think he wants lots of attention and treats and special things, and he does a lot of things to try and get them to do that. And they try, the way they cope is they try to laugh about it and with each other and, you know, find some humor in it. But I think they also realize how much their mom suffered with him. They didn't know that before she died. To kind of shield it, that us all from, I think, the difficult person he was.
So he may be somebody who doesn't want to do anything, who likes to be just receiving.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes. 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 And, you know, I mean, I think he has a type of social, that his dementia is manifesting itself in sort of social inappropriateness. So, you know, he thinks nothing of asking. And
what type of dementia does he have?
You know what? We know he has probably a little Parkinson's. He's just early stage, just very sort of forgetful, really couldn't handle, you know, couldn't probably bake a cake, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think my mother-in-law gave him a beautiful life. Mm-hmm. And she would like her children to continue that. And he doesn't understand why they wouldn't want to do that. He's just a very self-centered individual.
Yes.
Which I think is something that happens.
Yes.
I'm not an expert on aging and dementia, but it seems sometimes like when I've been into convalescent hospitals for assisted living, as he lives in assisted living, they're not interested in sort of interacting with one another. They're waiting for you to show up. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're looking at the door.
Mm-hmm. You know? Oh, then they're in the wrong place.
Well, exactly.
The facility my husband's in, he's never in his room. Never. He's out pushing somebody's wheelchair. He's picking up little bits of whatever on the floor that only he can see. Mm-hmm. He waters the flowers. I listed all these things. My goodness, he's busy. He straightens up his shoes in perfect rooms on the floor.
That's wonderful.
He helps other people with their clothes. He wants... I guess what I listed are all the things that I like best about him, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's always busy.
That's great. That's a very good situation for him.
Yes, I'm kind of in the right place.
Yes,
he's getting along.
I think sometimes that could be a difference between personality.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Or even culturally.
Absolutely.
And generational, too. Mm-hmm. And how a man was taken care of and who did that, who did those jobs.
Yeah. And I think he was your husband. Mm-hmm. This was their stepdad. Mm-hmm. And it's a totally different.
No, he still thinks of himself as a husband, probably.
My guy or your guy?
I'm not talking about my dad. I'm talking about your.
Oh yeah, he's
taken care of.
I think he'd still love to be pampered. Yeah.
One more comment, and then we're going to move on. Yes.
To reiterate what Diane. I feel a pretty good welling up of anger too, because what I realize with our situation is that this person is getting better care than she's ever gotten in her whole life from very aware people. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to do one more thing for this person. Mm-hmm. And it sounds pretty unspiritual.
But it's part of the mindfulness, right? It's being aware, getting in touch with the emotions, whatever they are.
Yeah.
You know?
So this is what this brings up for me, even though I end up doing more and more, it's has the bite of resentment and then guilt and remorse because of my spiritual life for 30-some years of all the training. It's like it becomes a no-win kind of prison situation.
You know, and when I do family caregiver support groups, there's so much anger and resentment and rage
and jealousy.
And some of these women, they just don't want to do this. They didn't bargain for this, and they're like, I don't want to do this. So it's part of the mindfulness practice is to be with that and learn how to, you know, and sometimes there's things you need to do. It's not just about practicing mindfulness. You know, there's concrete solutions, respite, or things like that need to be put in place. So I'd like to shift a little bit and go back to the mindfulness practices. And this one is called Stop. And that's one that's very short, and that everybody I teach it to, they love it. They just say, this is so useful. So it's like when we're doing the check-in, you know, a few minutes check-in. This is even shorter. So this is throughout the day, these little tune-ups of awareness. So it stands for stop, take a breath, but it's more like find a breath, observe what's happening within me, and then proceed. Stop. And I have stop signs sometimes that I give people in communities. You know, they have them in the elevators or in the bathrooms, and it's just a reminder. And then you can also do the same thing as I was talking about for the practice in the morning, is think about habits you do throughout the day. That could be washing your hands, it can be answering your phone, it can be going under a door, and then tie that habit of stop to that practice of stop to that existing habit. And it's just a reminder to, throughout the day, to come back to ourselves. Very simple. 30 seconds. Can you think about what would be a habit that you have throughout the day that you could attach this to? Anybody? Yes.
I don't have a dishwasher, and I don't really want a dishwasher. I haven't had one in years. I came to a retreat day long, and I told, and my husband was beautiful, and I told Lori, I said, my practice now is running down the hall, screaming and closing the door and locking it, you know. And I said, this is not working very well for me, though. and so she says, well, you have to find little pieces, you know, to find. So washing, so back to the dishes. So she said, what can you do? Maybe when you're washing the dishes. And so I tried it. I'm washing the dishes, and I'm thinking of Lori's words. I'm thinking, okay, you're washing the dishes. Nothing's happening right now. And that was like a miracle. It was like, you know, it was like somebody put the pause button, because there wasn't, not ever 1 second. And so I felt, you know, like you were saying, you're so overwhelmed that you don't even know where the stop sign is. You know, if you were tripping over it, you know, on the way down the hall. And so that stopping, I think, is what happens.
Right.
If you attach it, like something washing, or cooking some food, or, you know, or putting the laundry in the washing machine. Any of those things that you have to do, like you said, with your robe putting on, if you attach it to that,
yes,
then it's not just doing the dishes. Oh, I'm doing the dishes now. I'm not worried about anything. Oh, I'm putting the laundry in the washing machine. Oh, nothing bad is happening right now. So it really took that.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
It really took that.
And it's focusing on what you're doing in this case. Here, the stop is for the breath, but you could just use the, you know, there's a rabbi at Stanford, because they have to wash their hands between each patient. So he actually uses the sensations. His awareness goes to the water, and as he's washing his hands, he really pays attention. He goes, drops right into the hand washing in the water, and that's his stop, you know, his breaks, his mini breaks. So that's another very simple practice that you can bring anywhere, anytime, that helps reducing the stress. Okay, so now I'd like to shift a little bit, and we're going to stand up and do some walking. So I would like to invite you to go probably outside, right? And to do some, but before you go out, I just wanted to give you a little bit. So we're going to do some mindful walking. How many of you have never done mindful walking? Okay. So it's very simple. You just pick about this long stretch, and you go back and forth and back and forth. So you can get really fancy with walking meditation. But I'd like to teach you one that's very simple. You can take it at home. You don't have to really take it so. Just focus on your feet and the whenever your foot touches the ground, feeling the solidity of the foot against the ground. And that's all you do for each step. You know, left, right, and you go very slowly. And this is not about going anywhere. It's just about the same way we've been using the breath or the sound, this time we're using each step to just ground ourselves and to give our mind a break and just focus on just the feet. And then, of course, when you do that, your mind is going to do its thing. And every time it wanders, you know, if your heart gets overwhelmed with emotion or something, just notice that and then go back to the steps. Okay? And without judgment. Whatever comes up, acknowledge it. So we're going to do that for 15 minutes. And I'll come and get you when it's time.